on this edition of the Self-Publishing Show.
I think it's important to have all your ducks in a row and have all your facts straight, you know, so they have an idea at least of what law enforcement is before they start, you know, maybe heading down that path.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome to the Self-Publishing Show with me, James Blatch.
And me, Mark Dawson.
Mark Dawson, how's your week going? Or has it gone? It's Friday.
It's Friday the 13th as we record this. So yes, so far, not too bad. Busy, lots of things going on.
Launched a book this week, I think.
It'll be Monday. So as we record this, it'll be just after the weekend. So yeah, it's been in launch mode this week. Actually launching two books. I've got a German translation of the 10th Milton book and the 18th book in the series in English coming out. So I've been kind of pushing the pre-order on that one, and it's gone quite well. Should have about 10,000 pre-orders by the time we go live, which is lovely.
There are 18 John Milton books now.
Yeah,
is he not tired?
No, he's fine. He's ready for action. Going to be, have 20. I think we'll get to 20 without too much bother, and then we'll see where we are.
How old is he now?
He's slightly older than you. So,
oh, quite young then.
He's got a lot of 62.
What? It's not slightly older than me. He's 62, is
no,
he?
No. I don't
how old
know.
Is he?
It's
you
one
don't
those,
know how old he is.
I do.
Your God, though, in his
I
world.
Know roughly how old he is, but it's one of those things that you don't really, I don't think it's really necessary to put an age on a character.
You'd tie yourself down a bit, wouldn't you? It'd be just another thing for you to have to keep track of and remember.
Yeah, there is a kind of a Bible for the series, so I do know roughly how old he'd have to be. And he is getting to the age now where he'd feel like me in the mornings after, you know, disposing of the bad guys. Funnily enough, I had my daughter kicked me on the leg last night playing, and she had her shoes on, and she must have caught my leg just on some particular part of the muscle. It was up on the thigh. And I don't know if you've ever had this done before. This couldn't be less relevant to what we normally talk about. But my whole leg locked up. The muscle kind of just it swelled.
Like a spasm.
It was exactly like a spasm. And I couldn't move my leg. I had to have heat on it and then cold. And it's better today. It's still sore. I can't kneel down because my leg won't just it's just locked. So anyway, that's what Milton is like now. He has a bit of a rough and tumble with the bad guys, and then he's putting deep heat into his muscles for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I think the average age of people in our community, people listening, is somewhere between 30 and 50. You know, it's that sort of, generally from when we go and meet people, that's generally where they sit.
And, I'd push it up a bit more than that. I'd say between 30 and 65, I would say. I know that's pretty, that's pretty wide.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe, and not so many at the 30 end, probably is a bit more midlife, but the people at the upper end of it. And we are talking to somebody who's just retired from their main job in a moment today, that yes, you do notice those little injuries take a little bit longer to recover from. Having said that, I'm 53 and I ran my personal best 10K yesterday, which I was very pleased about.
How fast was that?
Not very fast, because I've never been a great runner, but it was 56 minutes something.
That's very good.
So, yeah, I was really pleased with that. So, yes, life in the old dog, yes. Okay, we do have a bit of an announcement now. I'm afraid it's a bit of a tease if you're listening to this at the time it's being released on the Friday. And that is that for Black Friday, we're going to do a deal. Now, normally we don't discount the main courses for a start unless you've bought a previous course. They're the only coupons we've ever done. However, we now have three craft courses which are available all year, all the time. One's on how to write a bestseller, the formula going into that. One is how to revise your book to go from good to great, and one is on cover design, so you understand the elements needed for a good cover that's going to help sell your books and possibly DIY it yourself or then outsource it. These are three brilliant courses. All three have had stellar reviews from those people who've been enjoying them. And for Black Friday, we are going to bundle them together at an exceptionally good price. It'll It'll run for just 1 week from Friday to Thursday night, and that's going to be available. We will post the relevant URL and the deal itself into our Facebook community group next week, probably on the Friday itself, on Black Friday itself. And just to also say, those of you who bought the revised course in the last month, you'll get a separate email, because it's a bit frustrating, is it not, to have just literally paid out for one course and then see a really good deal that includes that course. So we're going to do something for them in particular. But otherwise, even if you do own one of those other courses, you might want to, for this price, it'll still be worth getting the other two. So that is going to be announced in our Facebook group and via email, the usual sources, but watch out for that next week. It's going to be a very limited time, and then that'll be it, and they'll be back up to their full price of $297 each. Okay, so with that little tease done, let's talk about our interviewee. We have one of my favorite guests on today, actually his second appearance, because we caught up with him in a Vegas hotel room a couple of years ago. But this is Patrick O'Donnell. Patrick is a former police officer. When we were talking to him, he was about 3 months away from retirement on a life on the streets as a sergeant, actually, you know, a police officer, ranking police officer and a sergeant in Milwaukee, in a tough neighborhood, tough district. And there were murders every few days there, and he's dealt with everything you could possibly imagine. And we did feel like we were writing the opening passages of a tragedy, didn't we, Mark? Felt a little bit like, I've only got 3 months left on the force. And you know, from experience of reading these books and watching these films, what's going to happen. But I'm delighted to say, and I breathe some relief to say, that he has successfully retired his job. Had a pretty of a tough time since, because things melted down on the streets in America this summer just after he retired. And he went through, he talks about it in the interview, a real period of feeling guilty about not being there anymore and helping his colleagues and friends. But what Patrick is very good at is shining a light, shining that police flashlight on the areas of police procedure that the people like you, actually, in particular, Mark, who write stories that involve that side of life, could do with knowing. Not necessarily to get every single little bit right, because you'd have to be geeky about it, but you kind of do have to know what you're playing with, what you're deciding to stretch, and what is getting right. So, well, should we listen to Patrick, and then you and I can have a chat off the back of that about implementing some of the things that that Patrick's talked about. So here is Patrick O'Donnell.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Patrick O'Donnell, we had a chat with you in a Vegas bedroom. I know what happens in Vegas is supposed to stay there, but we broadcast that to the world.
That does not sound appropriate.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's not great stuff. But I remember that interview being about you and your history, and you were, you know, you're running out the clock in your police career, which is amazing. And it was a great interview. People, if they haven't heard it, should go back and listen to that. But you introduced this idea of the Cops and Writers sort of workshop thing you've got, which is a community, it's a Facebook group, it's a couple of books now, of really helping writers with some of the factual nitty-gritty of frontline policing. And do you know what? I went onto the Facebook site when I got back, and it quickly became my new favorite place to go.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
No, honestly, I would say, it's the same as turning on Netflix and watching a crime doc, which I do also find fascinating. Just reading through some of these questions people have, you know, I get to a murder scene. What would I need to arrest somebody who I just have a hunch about? How does that work exactly? And what are the procedures? How long can I hold somebody? You know, what if they threw the knife away? How big an area do you secure? And all these really interesting questions. And you've created this community of people like yourself. You're not the only cop in that, obviously, is there answering questions, former cops, and other writers sharing their stuff. So that's the background. That's why you're here. You've got another book to add to your canon of really interesting factual books on this area, and that's what we're going to talk about. But before perhaps we talk about that, I should say congratulations on your retirement, because last time we spoke, you were in uniform.
Thank you.
You're now out. How is that going? Are you missing it?
I'm not missing all the BS. There's plenty of that. When everything kicked off and the city that I worked in had some very serious riots, one of our police officers got shot. It was a hot mess. You know, my guys were working 20-hour days, and it was just crazy. And I had a just boatload of survivor guilt. You know, I could not sleep at night. You know, I'm looking it got to the point where I couldn't even watch the news because I'm thinking to myself, well, why should I be warm and cozy at home while those guys are out there getting everything thrown at them, going through, you know, again, getting shot, you know, getting rocks and bottles pelted at them, and I'm at home. So that was very tough to deal with.
I can understand that.
My wife was very good to me, and she said, you know what, you've been through lots of riots. You've had all kinds of stuff thrown at you. You know, you did your time. So that's the way I'm looking at it for now.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I can understand you feeling like that because it's a state of mind when things are going off. It's involved you at an intensive level for so many years. But that's not the way it works. The way it works is you do your time. You do your decades. And you should be happy for yourself and happy for your colleagues when they get to that point and their time is done as well.
So, yeah, I am very happy to be retired. There is no doubt about that. Retirement's really cool. But I'm busier now that I'm retired than when I was working.
Yeah, well, that's partly because you built up this fantastic community, I'm sure. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about, first of all, the Facebook group. So this is called Cops and Writers. And did you start it as a sort of a place for crime writers to post their questions? Was that the idea?
Yes. It all started out, you know, I've published other books. I published 3 other books before I started the Facebook group, and it had nothing to do with police work. But I had people asking me questions. You know, the deeper I got into the indie community, you know, I'm heavily involved with the 20 books to 50K group. I'm involved in your group. And, you know, you go to conferences and people would automatically just come up to you and say, hey, you're the cop. You know, what would happen if, you know, this occurred? How would a police officer handle this? Would a detective do that? Does he have enough to arrest somebody? And I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's like, I should start a group helping these guys out. So I did. And I also knew that I had bigger aspirations for it. And part of that was writing books to help out authors and screenwriters. And I love the term, dig the well before you're thirsty. So it was a two-pronged attack, I guess. One was, okay, I'm going to help out these authors. And secondly, this is kind of market research. You know, is this viable? Do you think that there is a market for a book like this? Is there a market for courses or a podcast? You know, I'm kind of dipping my toes in the water just to see, you know, what I did was I started the Facebook group before I wrote the book. And it just kind of exploded from there. You know, when we met back in last November at 20 Books in Vegas, I had about 900 members. Now there's over 2,600. So, wow. Yeah, I couldn't be happier. And it doesn't work except for the fact that I have really good people in there that ask really good questions. And I have other members of law enforcement literally all over the globe. So if somebody has a question about UK police procedure, you know, I was never a cop in the UK. What, you know, I have an idea and I can help, but I have UK police officers and detectives.
Yeah. Well, I'm just having a look now. So the most recent question posted an hour ago by Marissa is a UK question. She asks,
yes,
if the perpetrator of a hit and run is later located and is under the limit when he's found hours later, but there's proof he was in a pub earlier that day, could he still be prosecuted for drunk driving, or do the police need to have a positive breathalyzer result? So these are the sorts of questions that are really good for writers to ask, because the easiest thing is to make something up, some procedure, and you will lose credibility, not just from the odd policeman who or policewoman who reads your book, but also from people who just know the answer to that. You know, they've had a brush with the law or whatever it is. And it's like any book. And I think particularly this area, because it's a very public thing, policing. You know, the military stuff I write, me and a bunch of geeky people like me understand some of those things will spot errors, but actually the general public don't. But policing right. is very visible, very public. We're all part of it. Most of us know people who work in law enforcement. I think it's really important to get that stuff right. And so, yeah, you got an answer, I think, from one of your law enforcement colleagues here in the UK who explained yes, about I something did. Called a back calculation. I don't know if you have that in America as well, do you?
Well, what happens is that's very expensive. He doesn't mention that. So right. if it's just a regular drunk driver that, you know, maybe hit a stop sign, bent the stop sign and didn't hurt anyone, odds are, I mean, he'll still get arrested. But it depends, you know, if it's a week later, nothing's going to be able to test that. You know, you might be, you could get arrested for a failure to report an accident or, you know, leaving this hit and run, that type of thing. But the drunk driving portion is going to be very tough Now, if there is a death or very serious injury involved, the department will spend the money and they'll do everything they can and hope that, you know, science will help out. And where there are blood tests, and it's going to have to be blood, to hopefully, you know, back calculate what the person's blood alcohol content was at the time. So it's not something that happens every day. It's very rare, but it does happen.
And there, you know, there is the learning process. You can, people start to see why this Facebook page is quite addictive to read some of these these questions. Are you compiling a repository? I mean, your books are, I guess, is sort of this, but is the Facebook group itself, I think over a period of time, is going to become a place of really valuable knowledge, and Facebook groups aren't the easiest to search. Is there a plan to make this a sort of database, a sort of FAQ type thing at some point?
Funny you should mention that. I was kicking around the idea of make that would be my next book, the most popular questions from the Facebook group, and, you know, organize it into, like, you know, say criminal investigations, traffic stuff, like what we were just talking about, or just general, you know, how does somebody become a police officer? Do the questions from actual people, from authors. So that's probably the next book. And I'm going to start testing that to see if it has enough interest where people would, you know, would want to pick it up. It would be something more on the lighthearted side and probably not super long, but like you said, it would be a handy reference guide.
Yeah, would be useful. What are you finding out about your fellow writers? Are they coming into this group and are the books you read fairly well informed? Or are you seeing quite a lot of mistakes in the way that law enforcement's described?
Well, it depends. I have defense attorneys. I've got prosecutors, former prosecutors, you know, former defense attorneys. They know the law pretty decent. You know, the police officers that are in the group, they know the law. They know the proper procedures, but different departments will do things different ways. So sometimes there isn't always, you know, a pat answer as far as, you know, an easy answer. As far as authors, it depends on how much research they've done. Some are very impressive. They've done quite a bit of research. You know, you could tell by the questions that, hey, this person has spoken to a police officer or a detective, or maybe they were a police officer or a detective. They were involved in law enforcement somehow, and now they're writers. I have a couple people like that in the group. So it's a wide variety. Some people are, I don't want to say clueless, but there's some people that are, you know, the learning curve can be pretty steep. And, you know, if you're never around it and, you know, all you know is what you see on TV or reading books, or God forbid the internet, yeah, it's not a great place to learn.
Yeah. That's it's all about the willingness to learn though, isn't it? It's about how people take it on board. You do occasionally get people who just sort of stubbornly think, well, I'm sticking with what I wrote originally, even if it might be wrong. But I do quite like it. And I've just spotted one there, an example of this where someone asks, in this case, Brendan asked, when an attorney comes to visit a suspect, is the conversation private or recorded at the precinct? And instead of someone saying it's probably not recorded, someone came in and said, it's unlikely we'd let an attorney in at this stage, which is quite a big bit of information to have, because whilst they could write the same scene, I suppose they'd have to add something at the beginning as explaining why the attorney on this occasion got through at the precinct to that stage.
Right. In 25 years of the district stations that I've worked at, I've never seen an attorney at a district station. Mm. You get arrested. You usually wind up at a district station. Usually it's the geographical area where you were arrested. And then after you're processed, you may or may not be questioned or interrogated there. Sometimes it depends. If the more serious the crime, the less chances of that happening. You're probably going to wind up, we have a headquarters. You know, like I said, we have 7 district stations. It's a city of 600,000 people, 1,800 members in the department. So say you're arrested for homicide, you're going to get processed and you're going to go down to, or you're going to get straight down to it's the police administration building. And that's the headquarters, that's HQ. And that's where the detective bureau is. So that's their backyard. So there's a city jail there. They'll get processed, you know, fingerprints and pictures, et cetera. If they're intoxicated, they can't talk to them. Because if you interrogate somebody that's high on drugs or is drunk, whatever that interview is going to be will most likely get thrown out in court for obvious reasons. You know, I didn't know what I was saying. I was high as a kite, or, you know, I was so drunk. I don't even remember talking to this cop. So it depends on what they say, personal observations, you know, et cetera.
Well, that's the sort of answer you get in this group. It's not just the answer you're expecting, but somebody questioning the scene that you've set up, which is useful. What sort of coverage have you got of the world? I can see the UK and the US very commonly.
It's literally all over the world. I have quite a few Aussies and people in New Zealand. Asian, not too many. Canada, I have some good representation. The UK is strongly represented. Ireland, UK, Spain, France, you know, a good chunk of Europe. And like I said before, you know, Australia, New Zealand. But yeah, it's amazing. What a world we live in. You know, 10, 15 years ago, this wouldn't be possible.
No, it's absolutely really good use of the internet.
Yes.
Do you think
for
a positive use of it? Do you think it's always important to be as factually accurate as possible in these novels? Or are you relaxed that if people want to go off grid a bit?
What I tell people, because I also consult with authors and screenwriters, and I say one of the first things I say when I start talking to them is, it's your story, but I feel there is a responsibility that you have. You know, especially like somebody like me, you know, writing a police procedural, you know, this is what happens. This is, you know, the two books that I wrote in the Cops and Writers series, you know, it's to help authors. And that's the Facebook page too. But also, you don't want to get called out by your readers. But one of the biggest things too is these people might actually read these books might be thinking about becoming a cop. So I think it's important to have all your ducks in a row and have all your facts straight, you know, so they know they have an idea at least of what law enforcement is before they start, you know, maybe heading down that path.
Yeah. So if they do go off, they're going off deliberately in a calculated way, knowing what the landscape should be.
Correct.
Okay. I suppose the other thing that is those, not just the nitty gritty about procedure, but some of the relationships, which I think can very quickly become quite cliche in writing. And this is common on TV and in films, as well as books. And one of them, I think, is that relationship between the FBI and local police law enforcement. We've had four FBI officers on here on this podcast before who say, in their experience, it simply isn't the case that there's this relentless tension and anger between them. In fact, it's always a working partnership. And she said in her experience, the local law enforcement are grateful that FBI have come in and they're going to take the case or they're going to help them out with it. Was that your experience, or do you see some truth in what is always trotted out as this hostility between the two?
No, you're absolutely right. And I believe it was Jerry Williams that was on your show. She's fantastic. She has her own podcast. She has her book and a website that's very helpful for authors. If you have questions about the FBI, just look up Jerry Williams, and she's just a plethora of information. Yeah, like what you said, there's no big fight. There's no big, hey, this is my case, get out of here kind of thing. And usually the FBI is not going to take over. They will help. They will offer their expertise. They may have resources that a local PD do not have, and they might be a little more hands-on in a smaller department that doesn't have the experience, say like a New York or a Chicago, where, you know, you have a homicide unit that's 24/7. Like where I worked in Milwaukee, it was 24/7. There were always homicide detectives working. There was always sensitive crimes detectives working. You know, so when you would have FBI, usually it was task forces where you're kind of joining forces, such as like, say, human trafficking. We would have members of our sensitive crimes division, police officers, detectives, working with the FBI. And usually when the FBI was involved in something, it would only be one or two agents. You don't have a big team of FBI agents like storming the Bastille to, you know, this is my scene, get out of here, you know, coppers. And it's like, no. Say another thing that they might become involved in is if you have serial bank robbers. You know, banks are federally insured, so that is kind of the FBI's turf, and it's also the locals' turf. In the 25 years that I worked, very rarely would you see an FBI agent at a bank robbery, and I've gone to a bunch of them, but they would show up usually if there was shots fired, somebody hurt or killed in a bank robbery, or say there's a crew of bank robbers and they're going from town to town or crossing state lines, then they would get more involved.
Yeah, the state lines thing is a thing in the UK now as well, but I've kind of...
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, starting to catch up with the criminals, taking advantage of the change in jurisdictions, particularly sure. in the drugs world. And Mark ended up getting quite a personal view of that when there was a raid in a building adjacent to him, and he had a chat with the police about it. But it was exactly that. It was working with the intelligence that came from London, but the arrests sure. and raids being made in Wiltshire, which are two different police forces. So yeah, we're starting gotcha. To be familiar with that as well. Okay, so that's the Facebook group. And honestly, I do think it's you can while away an evening reading through that. And then you've got these two books. The latest book is Crime Scenes and Investigations, both under the Cops and Writers brand. And book one, which is about a couple of years now, I guess, is it, Patrick, is From the Academy to the Street.
Yes. Yeah, that came out about a year ago, last June.
Yeah. Oh, a year ago. Okay. When we spoke. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the first book, I'm guessing, is the background to the police training process of getting onto the front line.
Yes. You know, it shows how do you become a police officer? What are the different routes you can take in your career as a police officer? You know, go a little bit into like K-9 and SWAT. Motorcycle unit, horses, all the different ways you can be a police officer. And it just illustrated how you become from citizen James to police officer James to detective James, if that's the route that you want to take. But the long and short of it is most people who become a police officer stay a police officer. You know, the overwhelming majority of the members in a department are police officers or sheriff's deputies, depending if it's a sheriff's department or a police department. They're the ones that do most of the work. They're the grunts. They're the ones who, you know, either by choice or they just didn't do very well in a promotion exam. That might be a reason why they didn't promote or do something different, or they're just happy where they are. That happens quite a bit too. You know, they have a nice assignment. They feel comfortable doing what they're doing. And where I work, if you promote, like I promoted to sergeant after being a cop for almost 7 years, and I was slated to go day shift. I was working midnight to 8. And once I became a sergeant, I got bumped down to seniority, down to the very bottom of the barrel. So I was working nights again. I worked nights for 17 years.
Wow.
I would have been day shift after almost a little over 6 years.
Wow.
If I just stayed a police officer. But, you know, it's all trade-offs.
Yeah.
You know, what do you want? You know, so obviously, you know, more pay, more responsibility, but more freedom. And I think it was a lot more fun.
Hmm. Do people still call you Sarge?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm retired and, you know, one of my cops will see me like in a grocery store or whatever. Hey, Sarge, how's it going? You know, it just... That's the way it is, you know. And then some of them, like the newer guys, would be like, hey, hello, sir. And I'm like, it's not sir. Yeah. I'm just a retired guy now, man. Yeah, you can call me whatever you want.
Yeah, that's nice. Okay, so that's book one. Now, book two, which is really what we want to talk about today, which I think is, as we're recording this, is on the cusp. I think ebook, did you say, is out tomorrow?
Yes, I've had it on pre-order for about a week, and it goes live. The Kindle version goes live tomorrow, and the paperback went live, I think it was yesterday.
Okay.
And I'm negotiating with a narrator right now for the audiobook.
Superb. Okay, so this is Crime Scenes and Investigations. So this book is closer to the heart of what you've set out to do, which is to provide a resource for crime writers to get the details right.
Yes, you know, specifically, you know, Crime Scenes and Investigations. I go more into the Detective Bureau. I also do some work as far as weapons and firearms in police work and interviews, interrogations, and also, you know, literally talking somebody off of a bridge, you know, dealing with suicide negotiators, you know, what does a negotiator do? That yeah. type of thing.
And how much research did you have to do for this? Because obviously you were in uniform as a sergeant. There may have been aspects of the detective world that you wouldn't have seen on the inside so much. Did you have other input into this?
Yes. I've literally been to hundreds and hundreds of homicides, you know, probably thousands of crime scenes in my 25 years. When you're in a busy city where there's a lot of crime, like right now, we're on track to having the highest homicide rate for our entire, for any time. You know, the only time that it would be higher was when Jeffrey Dahmer was discovered and all the homicides that, you know, all the people that he killed.
Wow.
During that time, because he was a serial killer, you know, so we're on track to almost 200 homicides for this year. Last year, I think we had a little over 100 or right under 100.
So that's doing my math now. That's one a day, effectively.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, close to it. And then non-fatal shootings are probably going to be close to 500. So you're going to have more than one shooting a day almost.
Right. This is Milwaukee.
Yes.
How big is the city?
600,000 people.
That's the size of, well, it's a bit bigger than Cambridge, but I'm trying to think that's a lot of, I mean, Cambridge will have a murder once a year, maybe.
Oh, okay.
And it's probably 200,000 or 300,000, probably half the size, but nonetheless, that's breathtaking for me to hear that.
Yeah. You know, but Milwaukee's not an anomaly. It's happening all over the country. You know, this is nothing new. I'm not going to get into politics, obviously, because that's a rabbit hole we'll never get out of. But Milwaukee is not unique in that. We'll just say that.
Yeah. Okay. So you set out to educate people about crime scenes.
Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. You know, I interviewed a homicide detective that I worked with. I sat down with him and interviewed him, literally. Then I interviewed a homicide detective from LA. And I've talked to detectives in Florida, in New York. And, you know, I wanted to get a big picture because I know how my department does things. And I did that as far as the police procedure stuff goes also. You know, just because Milwaukee does something some way doesn't mean that, you know, LA is going to do it the same or Chicago is going to do it the same.
Right.
You know, so, and like I said before, you know, you have a small town, maybe the FBI will, you know, give them a hand if they have something really big. And then that same crime, they're not going to have anything to do with it in Milwaukee because we have detectives that do this every day. Whereas, say, in a small town, you know, it might be like where you were talking about in Cambridge. You know, you have one homicide a year. So it's like anything else. The more reps you have at something, the better you get at it. That's with crime scenes, investigations, all those types of things.
Yeah, that is actually one of the problems that crops up in the UK occasionally. And I covered a very high profile murder of two young schoolgirls. Mm-hmm. I was in the BBC. It became one of those cases that just became very famous. But one of the issues was that Cambridgeshire didn't have the experience of dealing with murders at the time. And they suddenly found themselves in a quite complicated, they were missing for 2 weeks. So there was a hunt as well.
Wow.
And I guess that must happen in the States. And your book, I don't know if your book touches on that. There's a very big difference, as you allude to, the being in the middle of, I don't know, Minnesota or somewhere in the Corn Belt and in the middle of Milwaukee. I mean.
Oh, absolutely.
And in terms of procedures and so on, I suppose they should be roughly the same, shouldn't they?
Well, you know, our ultimate goals are the same. We all have the same constitution. We all have the same rule book that is the constitution. But as far as working crime scenes, you know, it'll be different. So say there's a homicide. Where I worked, we had a team of homicide detectives. And you would have, say you had one or two dead bodies, you would have maybe 4 to 6 detectives that would show up to that. And there would be one lieutenant. Some departments have sergeants as well that are the detective's bosses. You're going to have a bunch of cops there. You're going to have a sergeant. That was me. Sometimes you would have a captain from the homicide bureau that will show up. That's usually during the day because usually captains work during the day. They don't work at night. And you would have all these people. And you might have one CSI person, the one who takes pictures, video, fingerprints, collects DNA, collects blood, that type of thing. But they don't physically collect the evidence. The detectives will document the scene. They will, and by documenting the scene, it's literally a steno pad and a pen, and they'll describe in their reports, because they're going to write a report later, what the scene is. You know, a male in his middle 30s, you know, laying in the living room, you know, face down, two apparent gunshot wounds to the back of his head. You know, and then they'll start describing if there's any evidence. You know, there was a pistol found in the kitchen. This is the make, model, serial number. You know, and then they literally have a tape measure and they just start measuring things. Like, say, if your homicide is outside, what you want to do is you want to have frame of references that aren't going to go away tomorrow. So a light pole, a fire hydrant, you know, the curb line, you know, the body was 3 feet from the fire hydrant north. And there's actually software now that can map all that out for you. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But you'll always have that, whereas different departments will have maybe one or two detectives show up at a homicide, and their CSI people will document the scene. They will collect all the evidence, as along with, you know, collecting the blood, fingerprints, DNA, all of those types of things.
And of course, this is critical to the process down the line. So you might be year later in a court case, and if a mistake was made on that first couple of days of gathering evidence, it can play havoc with the court case, which is perfect for a writer, by the way. Yes. to plan why the guy gets off or whatever.
Yeah, nothing happens quick. You know, a speedy trial could be a year from now. So you think speedy's like, oh, cool, you know, it'll be next month. No. You know, especially like a homicide, something big like that, the wheels of justice turn very slowly.
Yeah, that's certainly the same in the UK. And do you take the book chronologically? How have you structured it?
Yeah, pretty much. I started with just crime scenes. You know, who does what at a crime scene? Like what I was just talking about, you know, as far as who processes the crime scene, you know. One of the big misnomers that you see on TV or in books is you have a homicide and the first people showing up are like this little army of homicide detectives. They usually don't show up for a half an hour, an hour after the police officers and the sergeant secure the scene. So if there's fighting with the guy who just killed somebody or anything like that, we would kind of joke around with the detectives. We're like, you're second responders. You're not first responders.
Thanks for coming along.
Usually they're not the ones doing the chasing. You know, I remember my first homicide, I was still on field training. I probably had 3 or 4 weeks on the job, and we get called to a stabbing and they give a description of the guy. And as we're getting there, here comes a guy running out of the house, like running in our direction. And I'm like, oh, okay, he's got a knife in his hand. He matches the description. I jump out. I draw down on him, and I'm just like, holy crap. I'm going to have to shoot this guy. I don't want to shoot this guy. And I think I was more scared than him. You know, I'm brand new, and I'm just like, oh, so much for that job. That was kind of fun for a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, they're very dynamic, and they can change quite a bit.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that beginning bit, but you're going to have to tell us what happened in that situation. You're scared. He's scared. You're pointing your weapon at him.
Oh, yeah. I said, get on the ground. And he did. And, you know, put your hands behind your back. And he did. And I'm like,
thank God.
Does this happen every time? You know, in my FTO, the guy trained me. He's like, almost never. He says, usually they're running in the opposite direction when they see the cops. And I'm like, okay, I'll take it. This is my first bag. This is a homicide suspect. And, you know, unfortunately, the person, he stabbed him in the armpit. And that's not a place you want to get stabbed.
Yeah, it's a artery around there, isn't it?
Yeah, pierced a pulmonary artery. And I'm the new guy, so I go in the ambulance and they want me to get a dying declaration from this guy. And they're like, see if, you know, we know who killed him. Obvious, you know, it's pretty obvious, but you can't assume anything in any investigation. You know, maybe that was a relative and he was trying to hide the knife or who knows. And, you know, I'm trying to get a dying declaration, but he's got an IV in each arm. They got his feet up in the air. And I'm like, well, I'm not a doctor, but I know this does not look good. And he just couldn't talk. He was just gurgling more than anything else. And I'm in the trauma room and he crashed 3 times before he died. You know, that's another thing that just drives me crazy among many things in crime dramas is you get to a hospital. And in TV, you know, they do CPR on this guy for maybe a minute and they call it, okay, call it. Yeah, he's dead. I'm like, no, they work on people literally for an hour or more. I mean, they give it everything they got. I got nothing but respect for those medical professionals that work. It's
it's a little team. You know, you'll have three or four doctors, an army of nurses, techs. It's amazing to watch. But they literally cut this guy's chest open and started doing open heart massage. And here I am. I've never seen, you know, obviously I've never seen anything like that before. Here I am, Mr. Rookie guy. And I'm literally like right next to it as they're doing it, because the police officer can be in the room. And I'm just like, holy cow. I went home from work and I looked at my ex-wife and I'm like, this is the best job ever. You should, this is what I did today at work, honey.
Wow. Well, you've lived a life, Sarge.
Yeah, it's, I've got zero regrets. You know, when I was looking back on my career and I was thinking about it and I'm like, I got zero regrets. I really enjoyed it, but it was time to go.
Yeah. So you get into some of this in the book as well. So that was what my question I was coming on to is those first moments. There's a big difference between turning up, as you say, 5 hours later when your senior detective thinks this is a big case, I'm going to go and have a look myself, and everything's calm and ordered and there's tape out everywhere, and the guy on the beat in uniform who gets the initial call, who could be going to an active situation. It's a huge difference between the two. So do you deal with that aspect? You have talked about that, I guess, but...
Oh, yes. I touch on that in the book. You know, you never know what you're going to get. And again, you know, as far as your story goes, you want something compelling. And obviously, it has to last a while to keep your readers involved. You know, you don't want to pump out a book that's, you know, 40 pages. That's your crime thriller, you know, or whodunit or whatever. But a lot of times these crimes, it doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to figure them out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the prisons and jails are filled with stupid criminals. And, you know, it never ceased to amaze me. Truth is much stranger than fiction.
I suppose we have a distorted opinion of that because we constantly read whodunits and crime thrillers where it's not straightforward. And we watch even the reality documentaries that I'm addicted to on Netflix, The Staircase and others. They're always those cases that are intriguing, but that belies the fact that for every one of those, there's 100 cases where you walk up and there's, as you say, somebody running away with a gun in the hand or a knife in the hand, whatever.
Yeah, you know, I remember, again, I wasn't a rookie. I had about 4 or 5 years on. And the squad area that I worked had a hospital there. So people would dump bodies off at the hospital. You know, they'd shoot them here's a great story. This guy is at a bar. It's bar time. He's been chatting up this girl all night long, and he's thinking to himself, well, I'm going to get lucky. He's kind of an older, frumpy guy. He's probably close to 70 years old, real frumpy, and just kind of clueless. And, you know, this girl's like, yeah, I'm going to go home with you tonight. And she was a prostitute, but he didn't realize it. He was just, yeah, there was going to be some money transaction, and she had a history of prostitution. So, she's like, well, can you take me home first? I have to get some toiletries, you know, some clothes or whatever. He's like, sure. So again, he's thinking, this is going to be the best day of my life. This is the best night ever.
If it's
this
too good awesome. To be true, it's probably not. That's the old phrase.
He drops her off. It's in a very rough part of town. And he hears some kind of skirmish. And he sees this girl just come tumbling down the front stairs. What happened was, this woman goes inside the house, and the woman that she's living with, who is her partner, isn't very thrilled that she's going home with the guy. So fight ensues, and her partner stabs her in the chest with a barbecue fork.
Wow.
So here's this guy going from the best night of his life to the worst night of his life in half a second. So he scoops her up, puts her in his truck. He had a pickup truck, drove her to the hospital, but he actually stayed, which is surprising to me. Most of the time when I get called to something like that, there's a dead body. By then, you know, they already have him in a room that they were working on him. And I'm talking to the doctor and he says, well, first I see the guy and he's just in shock. So I had another police officer sit on him, get his basic information in the story. So I go in the exam room and here's this woman, you know, she's probably in her early 30s and she had two holes in her chest. And the doctor's like, by now she's pronounced dead. She's deceased. And the doctor's like, there's two holes here. I thought it was a shooting. I took an x-ray and there's nothing metallic in the body. And there's no exit wounds. And I'm like, I don't know either. So
I make all the notifications that I'm supposed to make. Here come the homicide detectives. And they're like, well, they're talking to guy and it's like, could you take us back to the house where this occurred? I said, sure, I remember where it is. So I go up there with the homicide detectives. I knock on the door. Lady opens it. And she, the first words out of her mouth were, it's not like I killed the bitch.
Right.
And then okay. Everybody just looked at each other like, oh, okay. And the barbecue fork is literally in the sink. There's still blood on right. the tip. And you're like, okay. Again, I don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure this one
out. Yeah. Yeah. She saved you a lot of trouble.
Oh, I've got more stories like that. It just, yeah, it's crazy.
And have you put some of those personal anecdotes into this book as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
So yes, I am.
Breathe some life into it. Right. Good. Well, Patrick, time's whipped through. We have 40 minutes of talking. I could listen to you all day, and I will do at some point in the distant future where we can be in the same room at the same time.
Over That'd a beer. Be fantastic. I will buy the first pint.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to that. And I'm also going to get a copy of Cops and Writers because I think it's important. Like you say, we said at the beginning, it's not absolutely gospel. You've got to get everything right. But if you're going to go off track, you should know.
Right. I think one of the problems that writers have is they become obsessed with, they have to have every little fact, you know, spot on. Instead of saying, you know, the person used this chemical to try to get, you know, blood, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like the CSI people came and processed the scene. There's nothing wrong with that. And then if there's something that, you know, is important to the story, yeah, they got 3 partial fingerprints and a palm print, you know, near the body on the coffee table or, you know, whatever the case may be. So yeah, don't kill yourself with that. Do your due diligence, but don't overdo it.
Yeah. Like you say, people are interested in the story and the characters and the journey. Just don't make it.
Oh, absolutely. I think the character is number one.
Yeah.
You know, the police officer. And then if you have a compelling, you know, suspect, you know, like or you have somebody like Dexter.
Yes. Yeah,
I just finished watching that on Netflix. I love Dexter.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And there's lots of stories, maybe not quite as prolific as Dexter, of people who in every way, shape and form, were right in front of you, but they didn't know. We have a famous case that bubbles up every now and again. The guy's been in prison for 20 odd years now for it, but called Jeremy Bamber in the UK. And they've done another dramatization recently. It's a really interesting one because he was the one, you know, in tears and showing the police around the house for several weeks before the penny dropped.
Wow.
And he still protests his innocence. I think because he got so far without without being nabbed, he thought he could get away with it. Look, it's brilliant. We could talk endlessly about this. We will talk again. I will just give a shout out to Jerry Williams' podcast interview, which is also in our background. I can't remember what number it is, but we'll get Catherine to put a link up in the screen there. So Jerry Williams came to speak to us about FBI myths. And that's a great interview to listen to alongside yours, Sarge. And you've got the whole gamut there of law enforcement and, of course, the legal side. That might be your next one. Do you think maybe moving into the process beyond the crime scene?
You know, my editor is a criminal defense attorney, and I had an entire chapter devoted to, you know, the criminal justice system. And some of it I got wrong. I mean, I know when you're supposed to Mirandize somebody, I know how the law works, but the nitty gritty, the real bits and pieces, she said, you know, and I thought to myself, well, that could be a book.
Yeah.
So I might do the Facebook questions one first. Then after that, it's either going to be the law and order, you know, criminal justice system, or I'll dive deeper into the forensic technology.
Yeah, fantastic. We'll look forward to that one as well.
Sure.
Patrick, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Congratulations on the publication of the book and, of course, your retirement. Do enjoy that. You've deserved it. And yeah, we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you very much.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
What an absolutely lovely guy, Patrick. And I said in the interview, I love his Cops and Writers Facebook page. It's like watching an episode of a Netflix series on crime because you get all these fantastic questions about what happens at the scene of a crime. And writers are midway through a scene and suddenly the policeman's arrived or the police officer's arrived and they're scratching their head thinking, would they pull their gun at this stage? Who would they talk to? Would they believe the first, you know, what's the sequence of events that's going to bring some authenticity to their books? And what a great service to provide for authors, Mark.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, it's certainly one. It's a service that if you're writing, well, personally, I don't think it's necessarily one that's restricted to people writing thrillers. You could have a romance novel set with a policeman as the protagonist. You know, so there are always going to be writers looking for someone to give you those details to get them right. And Patrick's, you know, he's good at that. And you know, something I have in the UK, just in the middle of about 40,000 words through the second Atticus Priest book at the moment, and I needed a bit of help to get Atticus into a certain situation last night. And I have a friend, another author, actually, he's becoming quite successful in his own right, Neil Lancaster, this Tom Novak series. And he was a fairly senior, I think I've mentioned him on the podcast before, he was a fairly senior, I think a DS, and was heavily involved in the Levi Belfield case. You remember that from not too long ago, a multiple murderer who was going around attacking young girls, typically. Neil's got lots of experience, and he's been tremendously helpful for me. We just have a little Facebook messenger chat going on, and I just say, you know, I've got a problem. How do I get Atticus into this situation? And he comes back with something that, you know, is at least reasonably plausible, which is all I need. It's indispensable to have someone like that, especially if you're writing something set in a contemporaneous world and you want to get the details right. You do need someone like that.
Yeah, and Patrick talked about the two books he's got out so far, both available, which go into detail in those areas. I think he's going to do a law process one after that, and possibly an FAQ-style book based on the questions and answers that pop up in the group. But the group's valuable, and I would recommend joining it if you write in anything like this area, because people ask the questions, and it's not simply Patrick as a former sergeant in Milwaukee answering questions. He's got police officers and lawyers in South Africa, lots in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, every country around the world are in this group, and you'll get answers. Sometimes you'll get a discussion between policemen about different approaches or different understandings and interpretations, which is also useful because it gives you an idea of some of the tensions that can exist at a crime scene that come in. But don't fall into the cliche of the police officers all hating the FBI when they turn up, which we did talk about. We often talk about, and Jerry, the former FBI officer, dismissed out of hand, and Patrick backed her up 100% and said they work closely together 99% of the time, and they're usually relieved and delighted that the FBI have come along to help them out on big cases. So it's such a cliche in films and TV, isn't it? Where they hate each other. This is my turf, which I believe is how they speak.
Oh dear. Okay. If you say so.
Okay. Thank you again to Patrick O'Donnell, and I really hope he enjoys his retirement. Do join that Cops and Writers Facebook group. It is great fun. That's it from me. I have nothing more of interest to say. Mark, you've got anything else interesting to say?
I have nothing interesting to say at any point. So no, we can be done with this, I think.
We can enjoy our weekend much as we can in locked down UK at the moment. But we'll make the best of it. Thank you very much. All that remains for me to say is it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.